This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
From Monday, February the 9th, sunrise can be expected around 7:30, sunset at 10 past 5. Temperatures will be low at around 2 to 4 degrees Celsius, and it will be quite windy.
Welcome to the Sandwell News for February the 7th for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell. Available by post on the internet, on our website, and as a podcast.
Some headlines from this week's readings from The Express and Star. Wednesday's news: recruiting more magistrates, co-op regional merger, Fawlty Towers comes to our region's theatres. Thursday, police answering calls more quickly, BB gun found in Tipton, Dawn a Still campaign to prevent football head injuries. Friday, warm home discount extended to end of the decade. West Midlands trains taken over by Great British Railways. Two Cradley Heath councillors to appear before magistrates charged with assault. Saturday, Led Zeppelin legend has whole lot of love for the West Midlands. Reform now a washed up party of Tories. Six signs your body is craving more water. Monday, Nesta to leave Albion role. Queen of Soul in suffragettes role. Learning from Chinese and Indian education systems. Knife crime drops but homicide increases. Tuesday, the Albion's problems. Cradley Heath development appeal. Donut day. Reducing the risk of having a stroke.
All those stories coming up from the local paper with kind permission of Express and Star newspapers. You heard that mention of the Fawlty Towers theatre performance, which I think is taking place at the Grand these days. I think that's worth going to see, because one or two of those Fawlty Tower episodes aren't being shown by the BBC these days. And we have a short article about the Grand Theatre as well coming up later in this edition. We've also the usual listings of radio and TV programmes for the week ahead, and a few more articles from Talking News Federation. And hope to end with a few comments of my own if there's space, but we'll get on straight away with the articles from the papers.
Hi everyone, it's Mia. I hope everyone's well. Today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles from The Express and Star, Wednesday the 28th of January. It's cobs galore, especially the burnt top variety at bakery. A traditional Black Country baker is attracting a host of fans across the West Midlands with his delicious burnt top cobs, gorgeous cakes and value for money. It's a place in Tipton which harks back to a forgotten time, providing traditional baked goods which reflect the heritage of the Black Country. Set in the middle of Great Bridges High Street, Bake My Day is like taking a step back in time, full of nostalgic cakes and pastries, as well as offering large and filling sandwiches and fresh bread. It is also well known within the community for its burnt top cobs, a style synonymous with the Black Country, with cobs, tins and other types of bread being baked on site, as well as at a unit near Sandwell and Dudley Rail Station. The shop, alongside another shop in Blackheath, is owned and run by Nathan Hadley, who works with his team of five to start baking at 3 a.m. and has proven so popular that even on a rainy Thursday morning, there was a queue heading out of the door. The 33-year-old Nathan said he had previously worked as a police dispatcher, but said he felt the need to make a change and invested in running a baked potato business in Oldbury, named after a popular saying by his late father David, before the opportunity arose to take on baking. He said, "I started up the jacket potato shop in memory of my dad, which was called All Right Spud, as he used to call us all Spud when we were kids, and I'd started that with £2,000 and was buying bread from the shop previously. This gentleman who owned it said he wanted to sell the business, and I acquired the funds together and bought the place in 2022, selling the spud shop to accumulate the money for this. We made a few changes, including bringing back all the old items, such as old school apple turnovers, cornflake tarts, sprinkle cakes, run bar bars, and the traditional old firkins, as this used to be an old firkins building. We then started doing tastier bread, changing a few ingredients to make it a bit tastier, playing around with the weights, and we found our own little niche, because whatever comes out the oven goes straight to the counter, and whatever isn't sold is given away cheaper towards the end of the day, then either used for bread pudding or given to local horses. Mr. Hadley said that around 2,000 small cobs, 400 large cobs, 14 large tins, and a wide number of other soft bread are baked each day, and said it was the sort of shop he'd said he'd want to shop at, and reflected on how providing a traditional shop has appealed to a lot of people. He said, "I always favour local high street shops, and I think the high street is a dying trade at the moment, with a lot of barbers and other things we don't need, and that's why I thought there was this niche here as people wanted traditional bread. I think that big businesses around here, like Tesco and Sainsbury's, are coming away from baking on site now and are doing industrialised, freezing the bread, proving it on site, which loses a lot of the quality and taste. With us, I thought local people want local black country bread and they want it straight from the oven to the counter, and it's tasty and warm and the dark top cobs go brilliantly. We call them 24 carat burnt, and a lot of it is traditionally black country, because if you go back, a lot of it was burnt bread because of the old ovens that they used to do it in, and they couldn't get it to a nice soft top. I think the rustic taste of the bread really resonates with some people around the black country, as it brings back that memory of childhood. Since opening, Mr. Hadley said the shop had been constantly busy, with people loving the hot pork sandwiches and bacon and egg sandwiches, and the hot cobs being the most popular item, as well as large eclairs, sausage rolls, beef and vegetable pastries, and cronuts. He said opening Bake My Day has been a life-changing experience for him, as it had given him more chance to be involved in his community, having spent 12 years working in an office. He also spoke about future plans for the brand, with one shop open in Blackheath and another soon to open in Oldbury. He said, "I know it sounds silly, but I think bread on a table, sliced in the morning from your local bakery, makes the world go round, especially the local community, because they know they can get their fresh bread from a local source and pay into a local business instead of a big business. I've got the shop in Blackheath, which is important to me because of the location, as there's a lot of footfall and an authentic high street. And Oldbury is close to my heart because it's my hometown, and I think the high street has been neglected from the retail park over there. If I can help local businesses around me, then that's great for everyone. Like the chippy next to me, which creates footfall for other businesses, and I'm proud to have created 19 jobs from my business, which is proper black country." I also just wanted to describe some of the pictures in the article. In the top left corner, we've got Luke Shooker and Andrew Kemp sharing a joke in the kitchen. It looks like they're baking the different breads, rolling them out, having a laugh. It looks like a lovely atmosphere. In the picture to the right of that, we have a very busy shop. People are queuing through the door. So again, it represents that lively atmosphere that we see in Bake My Day. It's a very busy bakery that the locals really enjoy. And then the main picture in the article is Nathan Hadley, who's holding a massive tray of the burnt top cobs, which look really delicious actually, and he just seems really happy. Obviously this business means a lot to him, so it's lovely to know that there's businesses like that that still exist. Campaign starts to recruit thousands of magistrates. Woman who suffered stroke gives back to the community and is now a magistrate. Ordinary people from all walks of life in the West Midlands are being called on by the government to volunteer their time to delivering justice by becoming a magistrate. A recruitment campaign is now live to recruit thousands of new magistrates to play a greater role in criminal justice as part of bold criminal court reforms to put victims first and restore public confidence in the system. Sheila Chingono, 35, has been a magistrate for 5 years and wants others to join the team part of government's plan for change to deliver swifter justice for victims and to protect the public. Magistrates play a vital role in delivering justice across England and Wales in a variety of jurisdictions, including in the criminal courts. They are all volunteers and are expected to dedicate a minimum of 13 days a year to sitting on cases, meaning many magistrates fulfil this crucial role alongside full-time employment and caring responsibilities. The launch of the campaign follows the announcement in December that magistrates will play a greater part in delivering justice as part of the government's response to part one of Sir Brian Leveson's independent review of criminal courts. Under the plans, magistrates in the Magistrates' Court will hear more cases as defendants will no longer be able to elect for a trial by jury for minor offences. Magistrates would also gain the power to sentence offenders to up to 18 months in prison, with an option for this to be extended to 24 months in the future. Currently, around 90% of all criminal cases conclude in the Magistrates' Court, with that proportion expected to rise under the government's plan. Sheila Chingono, 35, is determined to give back to her community after recovering from a stroke. She serves courts in Warsaw, Wolverhampton and Dudley from her new home in Nuneaton and is a determined volunteer. The stroke in 2023 left her paralysed on her left side, just 9 months after her wedding, and Sheila has fought back. Sheila said, "I have found my purpose, and people need to realise that they can do this. Help the community by being a magistrate. You just need an open mind, sound judgement, and the ability to work as part of a team. Training and expert legal advisors support you every step of the way. The rewards you get by making a difference are massive, and I want to break down barriers. People from all parts of the community need to be involved. I juggle a full-time job with volunteering, and it can be done. It needs to be done." Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy said, "Magistrates play a vital role in our court system, hearing thousands of cases across every jurisdiction and delivering justice. They are everyday people, and we need more people of every age and background to volunteer, not just to serve justice, but to serve and represent their local communities. Volunteering to become a magistrate can make a real difference to your life and the lives of others. That's why I'm calling on the public to apply and play your part." The current recruitment campaign is seeking to appoint several thousand new magistrates across the country over the next few years. Not only will it aim to appoint more magistrates, but it will also help ensure the magistracy better reflects the communities they serve. All magistrates are given robust training and an experienced mentor in their first year to develop their skills and legal knowledge. They are also supported with specialist legal advisors to allow them to deal with a range of cases. The top qualities that Ministry of Justice and the judiciary look for in potential candidates are good communication skills, a sense of fairness, and the ability to see an argument from different sides. Candidates are being sought to fill positions across all jurisdictions, including criminal work, youth cases, as well as certain civil and family proceedings. The Ministry of Justice is currently looking for people aged 18 and over to volunteer, with the expectation of 5 years service and statutory retirement age of 75. All magistrates receive full training, mentoring and ongoing support from a legal advisor who will help them follow the correct procedures. All decisions are made as part of a team of magistrates to ensure a balanced and fair consideration of cases. To find out more about becoming a magistrate in the West Midlands, visit icanbeamagistrate.co.uk. Co-op groups complete merger, bringing 1 million members together. A newly formed cooperative society operating across Shropshire and the Black Country has launched. Called Our Co-op, it brings together Central, Mid-Countries and Chelmsford Star cooperatives into a single entity. First proposed last year, the newly enlarged organisation now has more than 1 million members who continue to own the business, which is expected to generate annual revenue of around £1.8 billion. It employs 13,000 staff members and brings together a diverse range of functions, including more than 500 food stores, 70 travel agencies, 150 funeral homes, 40 children's nurseries, and broadband services, among others. Our co-op chief executive, Debbie Robinson, said, "Our new society brings together cooperative businesses that support people through everyday life and life's bigger moments, from feeding families and caring for children, to keeping the lights on, helping people travel, and supporting them through difficult times. By coming together, we can offer our members an even greater breadth of products and services that meet their needs. We have the scale and connection to generate more value through our businesses, reinvest it for the long term, and return more of that value to members in ways that matter. We are building a modern member-led society with bold ambitions. What matters most now is how we grow our society together, staying true to our beliefs while creating real value for members, colleagues, and customers. We're just getting started, and I'm excited about what we can achieve together." In October, Lichfield-based Central Co-op and the Mid-Countries Cooperative in Warwick announced they were proposing a merger and launched a consultation with members. That news came just 4 months after Central Co-op announced it was planning to merge with Chelmsford Star Cooperative, which trades across Essex. Elaine Dean, president of the new society, added, "The launch of our new society is a historic moment for the cooperative movement. Our co-op reflects what makes cooperatives so different and so powerful. By working together and participating, we can create a meaningful difference. Our unique family of businesses supports members every day and throughout their lives. And through our networks and partnerships, we can help other cooperatives to flourish as our society continues to grow." Stage show of sitcom classic Fawlty Towers comes to region. Fawlty Towers, the play, comes to Wolverhampton as part of a 10-month UK tour next month, starring veteran TV and stage actor Paul Nicholas and former Strictly Come Dancing champion Joanna Clifton. This production is directed by originating West End director Caroline J. Ranger and stars Danny Bain as Basil Fawlty, Mia Austin as Sybil, Hemi Yeroham as Manuel, Joanna Clifton as Polly, Paul Nicholas as the Major, and Gemma Churchill as Mrs. Richards. It has been 50 years since Fawlty Towers first broadcast on BBC Two in September 1975, and comedy legend John Cleese, who originally wrote the sitcom with Connie Booth, has chosen three of his favourite original TV episodes, The Hotel Inspector and The Germans from Series 1 and Communication Problems from Series 2, and adapted them into a two-hour play, complete with a new finale. Theatre-goers are in for a treat as this much-loved comedy masterpiece transitions to the stage. John Cleese said, "I'm thrilled with the top-class group of comedy actors that we've assembled for the UK tour of Fawlty Towers, the play. This year is the 50th anniversary of the first ever TV episode broadcasting on the BBC. I never thought that all these years later the stage show would get the reception that it has. But here we are, still making theatres rock with laughter." Following a tip-off that hotel inspectors may be visiting and eager to impress, Basil attempts to ingratiate himself with guests that he suspects are there to critique the establishment. The situation is further plagued by a party of Germans, the deaf and dotty guest from hell, Mrs. Richards, whose infuriating complaints prevent him from hiding a gambling win from his ever-vigilant and bossy wife, Sybil. Together, they run their hotel with a little help from the unflappable Polly, and very little help at all from Manuel, the trainee waiter from Barcelona who is the butt of Fawlty's frustration. Set in a fictional hotel in the seaside town of Torquay, only 12 half-hour episodes of the original BBC comedy were ever made. Based on a real-life hotel owner, Donald Sinclair, John Cleese came up with the idea for the character, Basil Fawlty, when he stayed at Sinclair's Green Eagles Hotel in Torquay and became fascinated with his incredibly rude behaviour. The iconic TV show won many awards and plaudits, including two BAFTAs for Best Situation Comedy, and in 2000 it was voted the best British programme of all time in a British Film Institute poll. Fawlty Towers, the play, runs at Wolverhampton Grand from the 10th to 21st of February. Tickets are available at fawlty-towerstour.co.uk.
Hello, this is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from the Express and Star on the 29th of January. Police force is getting quicker at answering emergency calls, by Gurdip Tandy. Average response times reduced compared to previous 12 months, figures show. West Midlands Police response to emergency calls the force receives has improved, data has revealed. A report to West Midlands Police, the WMP, and Crime Panel said the performance in answering 999 calls within the 10-second limit has improved, while the average response time has also reduced in 2024-25 compared with the previous year. The statistics, as part of West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster's annual report, also showed an improved performance in 101 calls. And they have also recorded a sharp drop in the number of people hanging up after waiting too long for their calls to be answered. The report said, in 2024-25, the total number of 999 calls received by a WMP fell by 10%, decreasing from 810,868 to 732,440 calls in comparison to 23-24. Call handling performance has remained consistently strong. The proportion of 999 calls answered remained static at 99.9%, demonstrating sustained reliability in emergency call response. Performance against a national 10-second call service level agreement has improved. Compliance increased from 93% in the previous year to 96% in 24-25, representing a 3 percentage point improvement. This indicates a continued focus on meeting service level expectations and ensuring the public receives a timely emergency response. The average answer time for 999 calls has improved, reducing from 5 seconds to 3 seconds in 2024-25. This represents a 40% improvement and demonstrates faster connection times, which are particularly critical in emergency situations where every second counts. There has also been a notable reduction in the number of calls abandoned after waiting more than 10 seconds. This figure dropped from 651 to 159, a decrease of 73%. The improvement reflects increased efficiency in call handling and fewer instances of callers disconnecting due to delays or other reasons. Turning to 101, there has been a 15% increase in demand, with 755,332 calls received in 2024-25 compared to 655,832 the year before. Despite this rise in call volume, the services responded well. The proportion of calls answered rose from 87% to 95%, an increase of 8 percentage points. There has also been considerable progress in meeting the 3-minute answer time target. Compliance rose from 76% to 93%, a 17 percentage point improvement. This reflects ongoing efforts to improve access to police services and to deliver a more responsive experience for the public. The average answer time for 101 calls has been substantial improvement, falling from 2 minutes and 13 seconds to just 36 seconds in 24-25. This 72% reduction demonstrates a significant increase in responsiveness, ensuring the callers are connected to the support they need far more quickly. The number of calls abandoned after waiting for more than 3 minutes has also dropped sharply. Weapons found to be BB guns. Two weapons seized by police during a raid in Tipton were found to be BB guns. West Midlands Police carried out the raid at a property at Laburnum Road on Tuesday morning and, after searches of the address, discovered two guns. The weapons were later established to be BB guns. However, the force has said that they can look like genuine firearms and cause fear and panic. A force spokesman said, "We carried out a raid at a property in Laudernham Road, Tipton, and after searches, discovered two guns. These were later established to be BB guns. However, we know that these can look like genuine firearms and cause fear and panic," added the spokesman. Women's award proceeds will help fund Safe Houses by Simon Evans. Award nominations are now open for the Black Country's main celebration of women and girls in 2026. West Bromwich-based Black Country Women's Aid, the BCWA, is staging its fourth International Women's Day event at the Hawthorne Stadium, home of West Bromwich Albion FC, on March 7th, the eve of International Women's Day. Proceeds from the event, sponsored by West Midlands IT consultancy services provider Hubtel IT, will go to BCWA's Key to a New Life campaign, raising funds to create 10 new safe houses for women and girls fleeing domestic violence. A purpose-built block of flats is set to be completed this summer. The highlight will be the Inspirational Woman of the Year Award, also sponsored by Hubtel IT. Nominations can be made on the Hubtel IT website until midnight on February the 6th. Hubtel IT will join the BCWA's judging panel to decide the winner. The 2025 Woman of the Year was Jo Downing, a specialist lymphedema nurse described as heaven's angel by one of her patients who said, "Jo genuinely cares. My life would not have changed without this lady." Fundraising for BCWA's new safe houses has come from activities including a skydive last year by Neil Bayliss, CEO of Birmingham-based Hubtel IT, and colleagues. At Hubtel, we are incredibly proud of our long-standing partnership with Black Country Women's Aid, whose vital support for women and girls relies on funding from organisations like ours, said Neil. BCWA's International Women's Day event on March the 7th, including the Inspirational Woman of the Year Award, promises to be a wonderful moment celebrating women and girls, with all proceeds helping to deliver 10 new safe houses, which, sadly, are more needed than ever by victim survivors of domestic abuse. Sarah Ward, CEO of Black Country Women's Aid, said, "We are very proud of the progress we are making with our construction project. Accommodation is hard to find at the best of times, but when you are fleeing violence and abuse and you need a safe haven at short notice, it is even more difficult. By providing more safe spaces, we can help victim survivors to stabilise, recover and start again. But we can't do this without the support of our community and the incredible partners like Hubtel IT. By sponsoring our International Women's Day event, Hubtel is demonstrating a strong commitment to supporting our work and to helping people in need live new, safer lives." And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Jo Downing receiving her award last year with a very nice bunch of flowers, presumably at the Albion Ground. Dawn Astle vows to keep pressure on government after inquest ruling. The government must recognise neurodegenerative conditions among footballers as industrial disease, campaigner Dawn Astle, daughter of former West Brom striker Jeff Astle, has said. A coroner ruled on Monday that heading a football was likely to have contributed to the brain injury, which was a factor in the death of former Manchester United and Leeds defender Gordon McQueen. His death, due to pneumonia, was owing to frailty, found to be through a combination of vascular dementia and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. It was another landmark ruling for those campaigning for greater protection for current players and improved support for past generations, following on from the verdict of death by industrial disease recorded for former West Brom and England striker Jeff Astle in November 2002. His daughter Dawn told the Press Association, "One of the first things my mum said to me and my sisters after the ruling was, 'Girls, your dad cannot possibly be the only one.' How right was she? One thing is very clear. We must continue to push government through the Industrial Injuries Advisory Council to officially recognise sports-related or sports-caused neurodegenerative diseases, including CTE, as industrial diseases. After all, that's what they are. Dawn, in her role as Professional Footballers Association, continues to lobby the IIAC.
Hiya, it's Gavin. Hope you're well. Here are some news articles from the 30th of January. Warm home discount to be extended for rest of decade. Millions of families to benefit from £150 reduction amid ongoing cost of living crisis. Millions of families will receive the £150 warm home discount every winter for the rest of the decade, the government has announced. The move comes amid the ongoing cost of living crisis, driven by soaring wholesale energy prices. The average energy bill for a household in England, Wales and Scotland remaining on a standard variable tariff reached £1,758 a year this winter. Regulator Ofgem said the latest 0.2% increase to the cap, which took effect on January the 1st, was being driven by the funding for nuclear power projects and discounts to some households' winter bills. The latest extension to the warm home discount, will see eligible households provided with the £150 rebate on their energy bills every winter until 2030-31. It follows the government's expansion of the warm home discount last year, adding 2.7 million families to the scheme and bringing the total number of eligible households to around 6 million. All households in England and Wales who are receiving a qualifying means-tested benefit should get the discount automatically as long as their supplier has more than 1,000 customers. Those who have not received a letter or the discount but think they are eligible should also call 0800 030 9322 by February 27th. The Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, DESNZ, said, separately, £150 is to be cut from the average household bill from April by scrapping the Energy Company Obligation Scheme. Energy Secretary Ed Miliband said, tackling the affordability crisis is the government's number one priority. That is why we are today confirming to millions of eligible families across the country that they will receive the £150 warm home discount every winter for the rest of the decade. That will give families much needed peace of mind that they will continue to receive vital support as we take action to bring down bills for good. Rail service taken back by the state. All change as West Midlands Trains transfers to new Great British Railways. A key rail operator which runs services across the West Midlands is being transferred back into public ownership. Transport UK is the company which owns and operates West Midlands Trains, but is preparing to hand over its services to the UK government at 2 a.m. on Sunday. West Midlands Trains will transition to DFT Operator, the government-owned company in charge of setting up a nationwide Great British Railways. Ministers say they want to significantly improve the experience for passengers who use trains across the West Midlands. Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander visited Wolverhampton Station to mark the milestone, which will see newly branded Great British Railways trains as part of a transition to public ownership into the next year. Transport UK Chief Executive Dominic Booth said he was happy that he was handing over a rail service on the West Midlands that was in good shape. He said, "We are proud of the work delivered at West Midlands Trains under our stewardship. By drawing on the expertise of Britain's most seasoned transport professionals, we have delivered a regional railway that serves the needs of the West Midlands community. Our focus has been on building an operation that performs well day to day and can be handed over in good order." West Midlands Trains runs rail services in the region under two brands, West Midlands Railway and London North Western Railway. Among its services are the Shrewsbury to Birmingham line through the Black Country and other routes around the region linking up with Birmingham International for the NEC, as well as the key cross-city commuter line from Worcestershire to Staffordshire via stations in Birmingham. London North Western Railway runs services from London to the North West via stations across West Midlands. The transition from Transport UK to the government will see more than 3,400 employees and 14 fleets move over. Transport UK said it had invested £1 billion in including new stations for Darlaston and Willenhall and a trio in South Birmingham. Two councillors due to face magistrates charged with assault. Two Sandwell councillors have been charged after an incident earlier this year in which a person was allegedly assaulted. Police confirmed Claire Mayo, aged 40, has been charged with two counts of assault and two of affray, and Daniel Millard, aged 43, has been charged with assault, affray and aiding an affray. Both charges relate to an incident which allegedly took place in the early hours of Sunday, July 20th on Surf 8 Hill Road, Cradley Heath. The two councillors are both from the Cradley Heath area and formerly represented Labour in the Rowley and Blackheath wards. Both are now independent. They are due to appear at Dudley Magistrates Court next month. Long life mostly due to genetics. Having a long life may well run in families, scientists have said, after they discovered genetics plays a far bigger role than previously thought. Until now, studies have suggested only around 10% to 30% of a lifespan can be put down to genetics, with illnesses, accidents and lifestyle factors such as eating well, not smoking and exercising making up the rest. However, a new study published in the journal Science has discovered that the role genes play in human lifespan is actually more like 55%. Experts looked at twin studies and found that when deaths from external factors such as accidents or infectious disease were lower, the role of genes appeared to increase. Historically, some past studies have also relied on hundreds of years worth of potentially poor quality data when disease and poor healthcare were common.
Hello, this is Linda, reading from Saturday, the 31st of January's Express and Star. Divine news all round with clerics and kofta kebabs. In the week that has welcomed the first female Archbishop of Canterbury and news of a Guinness kebab coming to the Midlands, it's not such a bad time to be alive. Dame Sarah Mullally was officially confirmed as the 106th incumbent of St Augustine's Chair on Wednesday in a ceremony at St Paul's Cathedral. Following the resignation of a previous Archbishop, Justin Welby, following accusations that he did not do enough with information he had about a prolific abuser in the church to prevent further abuse from taking place, Dame Sarah has taken up her new mantle with the pledge to do more on safeguarding. Though a heckler had a pop, Dame Sarah's confirmation ceremony went off without any other hitches and saw a woman finally take up the Church of England's highest elected office, although the C of E has allowed women to be ordained as priests since the 90s. This is the first time the top job, shy of the sovereign, has been held by one. Here's to a positive step forward for both women and the church. In other nothing less than divine news, it has been revealed that a Birmingham bar is set to launch a Guinness kebab in time for the men's Six Nations. Hallelujah! Arriving on February the 5th, the limited edition beef kofta kebab will be available at all seven box sports bars across the UK, including the one in Birmingham's Brindley Place, from the start of the tournament. As someone who admittedly pays homage at the altars of the Kebabalon, more often than he does at the Church of England's churches, this has quite possibly pipped Dame Sarah's confirmation to the post, for me, as good news story of the week. And with the following supply description, I'm expecting a few more converts to follow suit. The beef is marinated in Guinness, giving the meat the deep, rich flavour of the black stuff before being wrapped in a handmade flatbread drizzled with a sticky homemade Guinness chipolata glaze and topped with fresh mint yoghurt, say the architects of this glutinous gem. Yes, it even comes with a creamy white head. No more words, just get in my belly. The kebab is a great British institution, and the West Midlands and Shropshire boast some of the finest examples to be found across the land. Now that the January health kick is officially over, I'll be getting stuck back into plenty of them with gusto. For the back half of this week's musings, I'm going to pay tribute to a lady who despised Donna, gyros and shawarma in every form, but apart from this, she wasn't half bad. Yesterday would have been my mum's 71st birthday. She died in 2021 at the age of 60 after a battle with lung cancer. Despite her aversion to possibly the planet's greatest culinary pleasure, she was the greatest lady I ever knew and has left a hole that all of the mixed meat specials in the land couldn't possibly fill. It hasn't even been 5 years since she's been gone, but from the time we said goodbye, the world has changed so much, and I sometimes wonder how much of it she would now recognise. AI advancement would doubtlessly have made her feel uncomfortable, and I don't think she'd much have cared for the farce that the UK politics has become since she passed. She'd have been excited about plans for man to finally put boots back on the moon, but she wouldn't have pulled a hair over the Greenland situation or any of the Trump administration's rhetoric in general. Truth be told, I don't think she'd have cared much personally about Dame Sarah's elevation, but had she had the chance to meet her granddaughter, I think she'd have been encouraged about what the significance of this step and others like it might be for girls of her own generation. My mother was almost the furthest thing away from being a woman of the class that you could possibly imagine, much more a home sat at a roulette table than on a church pew. She'd have enjoyed the communion views, so in another life might well have been mildly tempted by casual Catholicism, but that would have been as far as she'd ever gone. With a devilish glint perpetually in her eye, I think it's fair to say that any chance of my daughter directly following in Dame Sarah's footsteps is unlikely. Yet, in a world where opportunities for women are a bit better than they were yesterday, she'll get to make her mark in one way or another. Happy birthday, Mum. Here's to your granddaughter becoming Minister for Kebabs. Daddy needs feeding. Led Zepp legend still has a whole lot of love for the West Midlands. These are the lads from the City of the Golden Black Temple. This was how Midlands hero and rock legend Robert Plant introduced Express and Star journalists to his stage crew when we interviewed him back in 2021. The reference was, of course, to the Led Zeppelin's frontman's great passion in life, other than music, his beloved Wolverhampton Wanderers. For while his exploits with Zeppelin, Band of Joy and Alison Krauss has made him a global star to rival the likes of Mick Jagger, Freddie Mercury or Jim Morrison, Plant remains very much a man of the Midlands. If he's not performing or listening to music, there's a good chance he will be enjoying a pint in his local or watching the boys in black and gold. Though he was born in West Bromwich, from an early age Plant opted to follow Wolves rather than the Baggies, visiting the Molyneux for the first time when he was very young. I was 5 when my dad took me down for the first time, and Billy Wright waved at me, he recalled, in an interview with us. Honest, he did, and that was it. I was hooked from that moment. In 2009, he became vice president of the club and remains one of its most devoted ambassadors, never failing to remember his roots and do his best bit for fans. In a very special treat last January, the Stairway to Heaven singer poured post-match pints for supporters at Wolves local, the Leaping Wolf. Although the game against Nottingham Forest had left a bad taste in fans' mouths, this was soon washed away as Plant got behind the bar. He was pictured pointing to the neck oil tap, a product of Beavertown Brewery, of which his son, Logan Plant, is the founder. Marketing manager of the pub, Daniel Morris, spoke to us about how the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ended up behind the bar. Reportedly, it all started when he was on his way to the match. He has a fob to get him into the Molyneux car park, but it had run out of battery. Daniel laughed. So he drove up to our pub car park and asked Nathan, the manager, if he could use it. Nathan said he could park there for free, we usually charge on match days, on one condition, that he comes into the pub after the game and pours a pint. Plant is said to have replied most definitely and stuck to his word. He came back after the match, Daniel continued. Everyone knew he would and we were jumping for joy. He was signing autographs, taking photos with everyone. When he was pouring the pints, it was our busiest time, and the whole room had their phones out recording. They are all rock fans and Wolves fans, so they were really happy. Daniel said his 68-year-old mum, who works in the kitchen, went to one of Robert Plant's first ever gigs and managed to have a special moment with him. She was really busy getting the meals out, but she managed to get a quick hug from him, which was great, Daniel said. He said he loved our pub and it looks amazing now compared to a few years ago, so that was really nice to hear. Plant's music, particularly that recorded with Led Zeppelin, is famous the world over, with the man himself consistently acknowledged as one of the greatest vocalists of all time. But while he is, of course, no stranger to stadium shows, Plant is passionate about smaller, intimate venues, such as those he developed his love of music. When I was a kid, he would go to Dudley Town Hall, Stourbridge Town Hall, or Coventry Town Hall, and you can see the Rolling Stones and all the other bands at that level, he said. Today, if you are a group as big as the Stones, you will be playing at Wembley. It's all very different. It will be very well organised, very professional, but you don't have that interaction with the audience. Plant's latest musical venture, Saving Grace, has been all about getting back to those grassroots venues, and in fact began as a collaboration rooted in his local pub. It's an undercover, underground musical revolution, he said. I was travelling all over the world, but when I came back to the Black Country, or as near enough as Dammit, I really wanted to continue to sing, and I found the Swan in Starport. The Swan is a pub with a strong musical tradition, and Plant was spotted singing alongside guitarist Rob Tennant from Seasden during a visit in 2016. It was there that he saw vocalist Susie Diane and drummer Ollie Jefferson performing, as well as guitarist Tony Kelsey. And Plant, though their diverse range of talents would make an interesting combination if brought together in a band, Susie and Ollie already had a really big reputation in this area, he said. Everyone here has their own history and reputation that is very important. Saving Grace plays a slow, soulful type of music, borrowing heavily from the 19th century American folk music and with psychedelic sound effects. Plant admits it is a sound that is hard to characterise. A lot of people call it Americana, but it's definitely not Americana, he says. I would describe it as psychedelic soul. Robert Plant and Saving Grace toured the UK last December, including a show in Birmingham that was rapturously received even after all these years. Plant still has a whole lot of love for the region. Reform is now a party of washed-up Tories. Nigel has created a big blue skip of Conservative detritus. Groucho Marx said he would refuse to join any club which would have him as a member. So it is a question for members of the Reform Party. Would they want to be members of any party which would have the likes of Robert Jenrick and Suella Braverman as members? The steady stream of new acquisitions of a Tory persuasion has given Nigel's project the appearance of being not just reform, but reform and recycle. An opportunity for washed-up Conservative politicians with bleak prospects to be cleansed and reborn. In giving them some R&R, Nigel has created a big blue skip in which he is collecting the detritus of 14 years of Conservative government. The unique selling point of reform is that it has been different from other parties, saying things they will not say and championing issues and causes those other parties think ordinary people should leave to the intellect and wisdom of the politicians. Lack of credible policies doesn't matter too much in the current electoral landscape, in which voters feel let down and whose trust has been so seriously eroded that they think they may as well vote for those they feel are on their side. Every Tory dud who joins Reform dilutes the party's USP, Nigel says. They are bringing with them much needed experience to a party sorely lacking in it. But is that such a big deal? When Labour came to office, it had been out of power for so long that it lacked any experience of running a government. Without wishing to spread alarm and despondency among Reform ranks, if Tory enterism continues, there won't be any distinct Reform Party. It will just be populated by Tories who have changed their political clothes. And there is going to come a day when Nigel himself falls under the political bus, or otherwise disappears into the sunset, and Reform will be looking for a new leader. With their much vaunted experience, nobody could be surprised if Bob and Suella threw their hats in the ring. Here's a scenario for the next general election. Reform and the Tories between them win enough seats to form a parliamentary majority. Merger talks begin. As they come together in a warm embrace, though, they would have to be given to a suitable new name. The Reunion Party. What a stroke of luck for Andy Burnham. The poor man's been hunted and haunted by unrealistic expectation. Being blocked from a parliamentary return saves him from humiliation and embarrassment. The idea that he could be next Labour leader is for the birds. He's got a track record of losing. In 2010, he stood for the Labour leadership, but came in fourth. Winner was Ed Miliband, who narrowly beat his brother David. In 2015, Burnham was front-runner in the Labour leadership contest, but wrestled defeat from the jaws of victory, being beaten by Jeremy Corbyn. Third time lucky, you might say. But in real life, things don't work like that, and there would be other candidates who would have a lot of support among the Labour rank and file, like Angela Rayner, for example. There is also a little matter of getting elected to Parliament in the first place. And, even if Andy hadn't been stopped from standing, there's no guarantee he would win a by-election anyway. He does have an advantage over Sir Keir Starmer in one respect. There are few places in the UK called Burnham, but none at all called Starmer. Burnham-on-Sea, I found an unpretentious little place, and have not had the privilege of visiting Burnham-on-Crouch. There was a news report on the telly this week about serious flooding in Tipton. It didn't look like Tipton to me. It turned out to be Tipton St John in Devon. A few months ago, I was in a village quiz in which one of the questions was, how many places in the UK are called Newport? I leave it to you to ponder on that for a few seconds. There are at least two Dudleys, Wolverhampton. Well, you'll not be surprised that there's only one Wolverhampton. Newport answer? 14-ish. Six telltale signs that your body is craving more water this winter. During the chilly wintry months, most of us have a tendency to wrap up warm, crank up the heating and reach for hot drinks rather than guzzling down glasses of water. However, it's important to remember that your body still needs consistent hydration to function at its best and has subtle ways of sounding alarm bells. Here are six signs that might indicate that your body is craving more H2O this winter. Dry mouth. The most obvious sign of dehydration is thirst, which is often accompanied by a dry mouth, lips or tongue, highlights Michael Zeminides, co-founding GP of A to Z General Practice at the Wellington Hospital, part of HCA Healthcare UK. Dark urine. A dark yellow or strong-smelling urine is another indicator, which usually means that the patient is peeing less often than usual, note Zeminides. Dizziness. Dehydration can cause nausea, dizziness and lightheadedness, says Zeminides. If you're dehydrated, your blood pressure will drop, and that can also affect your sensation of dizziness. Also, in extreme cases, dehydration can lead to confusion, which will make you feel even more dizzy and unsteady on your feet. Headaches. If you're dehydrated, you've got less water in your circulation system going around your body, which means that there's less fluid around the brain itself, and that can impede how it functions and cause headaches, explains the GP. Fatigue. If you don't drink enough water, you might begin to notice that your energy levels are affected and that you feel fatigued and tired, says Zeminides. It can also impact your concentration and how sharp you are feeling. Constipation. Water is quite key in how you're digesting things and the actual process of moving things through the bowel itself, says Zeminides. So if everything quite lubricated and moving smoothly, then you're less likely to get constipated. How much water should you drink every day? The government has quite simplified guidelines in the Eat Well Guide, which recommends about 6 to 8 cups of glasses of fluid per day, assuming that you're getting about 20% of your intake from eating food, says the Mindies. Why is staying hydrated so important? Water is essential for human life and is involved in every biochemical reaction in the body, highlights the Mindies. It plays a pivotal role in regulating our temperature, maintaining our blood pressure, helps support your kidney function and helps aid digestion. Therefore, being dehydrated can have a big impact on your body. Dehydration can become more serious over time and can increase your risk of urinary tract infections and kidney problems and lead to confusion, which can result in an increased number of falls, warns the Mindies. When should you seek medical advice? If you've got dark urine, you can probably manage that yourself. However, if you're experiencing those later and more serious symptoms like palpitations, that sensation when you're feeling unsteady on your feet, headaches, or you're just feeling unwell, seek advice from your GP, advises Zaminides.
Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday, the 2nd of February. Nesta to leave Hawthorn's role. Club president Andrew Nesta's two-year spell at Albion is set to end after a series of disastrous calls. Nesta, recently appointed president to go alongside the sporting director title, will depart the Hawthorns, having arrived as a close confidant of chairman and owner Shilen Patel. But a series of failed head coach appointments and disastrous transfer dealings have led to an imminent parting of the ways at Albion. The Baggies are working on appointing a technical director for the first time, and it is understood that move is in at an advanced stage. It will be the first in that role for 5 years since Luke Dowling's exit. Nesta was not in place for new boss Eric Ramsey's unveiling at the Hawthorns a little under 3 weeks ago. Patel spoke to the press on that occasion and showed his faith in the new head coach. Owner Patel selected Nesta, with the pair having worked together previously with Patel's minor stake at Bologna in Italy, to lead on the Baggies sporting matters upon the Americans' takeover 2 years ago this month. Several disastrous decisions at sporting level, including 3 head coach appointments in 12 months, have played a significant part in Albion finding themselves mired in a relegation battle to League One. Nesta, who was previously a general manager among other roles at Tampa Bay Rowdies in the United States, oversaw the process that failed to bring Swiss coach Raphael Vicky to the Hawthorns. He was also in charge for the Tony Mowbray debacle, which saw the much-loved former boss return to the club 15 years later to being given fewer than 20 games at the helm. The sporting director, prior to being club president in a new title, then led the lengthy search for a new head coach last summer, with Ryan Mason and Ramsey on his shortlist. The club appointed Mason, who spent 6 failed months at the helm before being relieved of his duties and Albion turning to Ramsey, his second candidate, last summer. Nesta, working above Director of Football Operations Ian Pearce, also took the lead on player recruitment with a series of terrible calls, topped by the £3.4 million acquisition of Tamer Bainey last January. Trailer shows Queen of Soul's return for suffragette musical. The Black Country's very own Queen of Soul is bringing the attitude and empowerment of the suffragette movement to the stage as a popular musical returns. Brand new artwork and a trailer have been released for Sylvia, the Olivier-nominated musical production, ahead of its highly anticipated return this autumn, and which includes a date in Birmingham. Wolverhampton's very own Beverly Knight reprises her Olivier Award-winning role as Emmeline Pankhurst alongside Sharon Rose as Sylvia in a UK tour culminating in a run at the Royal Albert Hall. Sylvia tells the untold story of the rebellious middle child of Emmeline Pankhurst in a hip-hop, funk and soul music. Whilst her mother and sister battled for women's suffrage, Sylvia ignited a revolution for the forgotten, working women, the impoverished, the silenced. Caught between her family and her beliefs, Sylvia risked it all to bring change to millions. Following its sell-out world premiere production at the Old Vic in 2023, Sylvia will feature at Birmingham Hippodrome between October the 6th and 10th and in other venues across the country before heading into the Royal Albert Hall from November the 13th to the 15th, supported by a grant from the Arts Council incentivising touring scheme. A spokesman for the production said, "The Olivier award-winning electrifying musical is fueled by an irresistible soundtrack by Josh Cohen and DJ Wald that joyously unites hip-hop, funk and soul and is brought to life by world-renowned choreographer and storyteller Kate Prince. Beverly has forged a formidable career in theatre. Her West End debut was the starring role in The Bodyguard, followed by leading the Tony-winning Memphis the Musical. At the request of Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber, she joined the cast of Cats, playing the iconic role of Grisabella. In 2021, Beverly took the lead in The Drifter's Girl, which was nominated for an Olivier as Best New Musical as the formidable manager of soul group The Drifters. Her role as Emmeline Pankhurst in the Old Vic's production of Sylvia in 2023 earned her both huge acclaim and her first Olivier Award win. Showing her versatility and comedic skill, Beverly starred as the Dolores Van Cartier opposite Jennifer Saunders in the revival of Sister Act in Hammersmith's Apollo's highest-grossing show ever in the venue. In 2024, Beverly reprised her role as Dolores opposite Ruth Jones at the Dominion. Most recently, Beverly featured as the godmother of rock and roll sister Rosetta Tharpe in her first professional theatre play, Marie and Rosetta, which will be returning to the stage at Soho Place on the West End commencing this month. To view the trailer, visit expressandstar.com. For tickets, visit Birmingham Hippodrome website. Academy Praise for Outstanding Behaviour Work. A Black Country Academy has been recognised by the Department for Education, the DfE, for its outstanding practice. The Q3 Academy, Langley, in Sandwell, is a newly announced lead school for attendance and behaviour as part of the government's RISE Hub School programme. Leaders from the school and trust will share their knowledge and experiences and offer practical mentoring support to schools across the West Midlands for the benefit of thousands of students. The Academy has become recognised nationally as a very successful school since opening its doors nearly a decade ago. Head teacher at Q3 Academy, Langley, Peter Lee, said, "All of us at Q3 Academy Langley are thrilled to have been selected as a DfE RISE Attendance and Behaviour Lead School. We look forward to working with the DfE and schools across the West Midlands to improve attendance and behaviour and create calm and supportive school environments that enable children to achieve and to thrive. We are proud of our track record since opening in 2016. We have pioneered innovative work to drive culture, including our family lunch, amongst other strategies, which we are looking forward to sharing with others." Why our schools can learn from the Chinese. This is an opinion column by Roshan Doug, and he is an educationalist and former Birmingham Poet Laureate. Why Starmer must take lessons from his trip to the Far East. Prime Minister Keir Starmer's visit to China has inevitably reopened a wider conversation about how the West understands progress, power and the future. As an education policy expert, I welcome this. For me, the visit also revives a much more fundamental question. Why do China and India continue to outperform the West in education, not just academically, but socially and culturally as well? This is not an abstract debate. I learnt much of this firsthand while working on a BBC documentary feature that took me deep into classrooms, campuses and communities in both these countries. The core difference lies not in funding or facilities, but in philosophy. Western education systems are increasingly shaped by individualism. We emphasise children's rights, personal expression and self-esteem, often at the expense of responsibility, discipline and duty. In contrast, China and India see education as a collective national project. The child is not merely an individual consumer of services, but a future citizen with obligations to family, community and country. In China especially, discipline is not a dirty word. Schools prioritise structure, routine and respect for authority. This is not about suppressing individuality, as critics often claim, but about creating the conditions in which learning can flourish. Classrooms are orderly, teachers are respected. Students understand that effort matters more than entitlement. The result is not fear, but focus. Equally striking is the emphasis on physical and mental health. Chinese and Indian schools integrate regular physical exercise into their curricula, understanding the link between bodily discipline and cognitive performance. Mental resilience is actively cultivated, not through endless therapeutic language, but through challenge, perseverance, and clear expectations. They value silence, contemplation and meditation. By contrast, Western systems often medicalise normal stress while removing the very pressures that help young people develop strength. Perhaps the most telling difference is China's approach to social media. While Western societies hand smartphones to children with barely a second thought, China restricts access because it recognises how social media corrodes attention, distorts identity and weakens social bonds. This is not technophobia, it is social responsibility. The West talks endlessly about online safety, yet refuses to confront the commercial interests and cultural habits that are clearly damaging young minds. I'm therefore pleased that Australia is copying China by banning social media for under-16s. India, meanwhile, offers a complementary model. Its education system places enormous value on academic rigour, particularly in science, technology, engineering and mathematics. Creativity is not dismissed, but is grounded in mastery. You learn the right to innovate by first learning the fundamentals. In the West, we often reverse this logic, celebrating creativity while neglecting knowledge, process and precision. The result, as far as I can see, is confidence without competence. During my documentary work, what struck me beyond the classroom was the wider social environment these systems produce. There was visible order, lower levels of everyday crime, and a strong culture of cleanliness and civic pride. These are not accidents. They are downstream effects of an education system that consistently reinforces responsibility, respect, and collective standards. None of this is to argue that China or India are flawless, or that the West should blindly copy their systems. But it is increasingly clear that Western education is suffering from ideological imbalance. By prioritising individual feelings over shared values, rights over responsibilities and expression over effort, we are undermining the very foundations of learning. Whilst we focus on identity, politics, sexuality and the undermining of grand narratives and traditions, China and India are focusing on commerce, science and industry. If Prime Minister Starmer's engagement with China is to mean anything beyond trade and diplomacy, it should prompt a serious rethinking of what education is for. China and India understand that education is not just about personal fulfilment. It is about national survival, social cohesion, and long-term strength. Until we in the West relearn that lesson, no amount of reform rhetoric will close the gap. Drop in knife offences, but homicide numbers increase. Data shows West Midlands police records year on year decline in blade crime. Knife crime in the West Midlands has fallen by nearly a fifth over the past year, according to new figures, despite a recorded rise in the number of homicides. Data published by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, shows West Midlands police recorded 4,116 knife crime offences in the year to September 2025, down by 881 on the 4,997 in the previous 12 months. The force was one of 33 out of 44 police forces in England and Wales to record a year-on-year fall in knife crime. Despite the fall in knife-related offences, the number of police-recorded homicides in the West Midlands rose slightly over the same period. A total of 34 homicides were recorded in the year to September 2025, up from 29 the year before. Funding and dedicated resources continue to be targeted at reducing knife crime for West Midlands Police, as the region has seen some of the highest knife crime offences per 1,000 population. However, the force claims it has continued to see reductions in the last 12 months. Acting Chief Constable Scott Green said, "The results speak for themselves, with continued crime reductions in the West Midlands thanks to hard work by our officers and staff. We are doing what the public expect us to do and what we are rightly held accountable for, arresting people, solving crimes and helping people feel safer. Over the last 12 months, we've arrested over 60,000 people and the number of positive outcomes, this includes where people have been charged or cautioned for an offence, has risen to just under 15%. As well as crime continuing to fall, we are delivering a first-class service answering 999 emergency calls within an average of 2 seconds and 101 non-emergency calls in 25 seconds. The force says that in 2025 it took 720,140 999 calls within an average answer time of 2 seconds and sometimes as low as 1 second, down from 57 seconds in summer of 2022 and 830,398 calls to 101 in the same year with an average answer time of 25 seconds. Acting Chief Constable Green added, "Despite these latest reductions, we must continue to work hard to ensure there are even fewer victims of crime in the future. We recognise that any offence is one too many. We are committed to continuing to do more to protect people from harm and focus on tackling the crimes that impact on people and their lives. Nationally, knife crime fell across most of the country, while police recorded homicides declined in nearly half of all forces. The figures are based on crimes recorded by police and cover the 12 months to September 2025. Billy Gazzard of the ONS said, "While the crime survey paints a relatively stable picture, many aspects of violent crime and theft recorded by the police have fallen in the past 12 months. Homicide and gun crime are at the lowest levels seen this century, while knife crime has also decreased." Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood said, "We are having success tackling crimes that terrorise communities. but crimes that tear at the fabric of communities like shop theft and robbery continue to rise, and we must do more.
Welcome back to the Express and Star pub quiz. Question 1. News. The Prime Minister was travelling to which country this week in the hope of securing closer economic ties? Question 2. Which weather presenter announced they would be leaving the BBC after more than 25 years? Question 3. Sport. Which county cricket club play home games at the Rose Bowl? Question 4. Name the reigning Wimbledon women's singles champion. Question 5. Remember when? Actor Robert Downey Jr. was born. Julie Andrews starred in The Sound of Music. The Rolling Stones had a UK number one single with The Last Time, and the Pennine Way was officially opened. But what was the year? Question 6. Mel Gibson starred in Lethal Weapon. Pet Shop Boys had a UK number one single with It's a Sin. Van Gogh's irises were sold at Sotheby's for £27 million, and the artist Andy Warhol died. But what was the year? Question 7. Who am I? A composer and lyricist, I was born in New York in 1930. My film knowledge got me through the $64,000 question tryouts. As a young man, I was mentored by Oscar Hammerstein II, and I went on to write the lyrics for many musicals, including West Side Story, Merrily We Roll Along, and Into the Woods. Question 8. A singer, I was born in Connecticut in 1950. I was a talented drummer and considered myself a drummer who sang. In 1987, Todd Haynes made a film about my life called Superstar, but it was withdrawn from circulation 3 years later due to copyright infringement. I formed a popular singing duo with my brother Richard. Who am I? Question 9. Local history. Which famous chocolate-making family were not just business people, but Quaker philanthropists who built an entire model village with gardens, schools, and swimming pools to improve the lives of their factory workers? And question 10. Even though Peaky Blinders is set in Small Heath, most of the outdoor scenes were filmed at a famous museum in Dudley. What is the name of this museum? How's your quiz knowledge? Click to the answers to find out.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Demi welcoming you to your audio-described TV programme starting Saturday the 7th and ending on Friday the 13th of February, written by Christine. Some of the usual scheduling makes way for the Winter Olympics coverage this week, but there are still some old favourites and new programmes to enjoy. So, starting with Saturday, after the Early Risers American Sitcom Fest from 6:15am through to 10:45am on Channel 4, featuring episodes of King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, Frasier and The Simpsons, you could travel to Leominster in Herefordshire for BBC One's Bargain Hunt at 11:30am. Can a repurpose of space outweigh a desire for postures new? In Kirstin Phil's Love It or List It on Channel 4 at 2:55, which is followed by Phil Spencer's New Zealand's Best Homes at 3:55. Into the evening, and the contenders continue their fight for a place in the quarterfinals of Gladiators at 5:45 on BBC One, and it's the semi-final of The Masked Singer at 7 on ITV, followed by quiz show The 1% Club at 8:30. The Reverend Richard Coles explores the beautiful coasts beyond the poetic sounds of the shipping forecast on Channel 4 at 6:30 in Sailing the Shipping Forecast, followed by 60-foot waves, killer whales, hypothermia and tongue rot in the Great Icelandic Swim with Ross Edgeley at 7:30. Over on BBC One, Casualty at 8:30 is followed by the final episode of Waiting for the Out at 9:20, while Channel 4 has Alice Roberts uncovering the secrets of Rome's success in a new series, Roman Empire by Train, at 8:30. An elite force of female warriors protect their West African kingdom in Channel 4's historical action film, The Woman King, at 9:30. And on ITV, It'll Be All Right on the Night concludes your evening choices at 10:30. On to Sunday. Again, fans of American comedy sitcom series can get an early fix from 5:55 a.m. right through to 1:55 p.m. on Channel 4 with King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, Frasier and The Simpsons. The Fletcher family need a local farmhand to help them manage their livestock in Fletcher's Family Farm at 11:30, while Bargain Hunt visits Wetherby Racecourse on BBC Two at 12:20, followed by More Digging for Britain at 1:15. You also have an afternoon film choice, animated adventure comedy sequel Shrek Forever After at 1:15 on ITV. Into the afternoon, Channel 4's George Clark's Amazing Spaces is at 3:20. Then at 4:25, Sandy Toksvig and her wife Debbie get the chainsaw out to save a patch of ancient woodland in Great British Woodland Restoration. At 5:25, you can meet Brixham's Maverick Skipper, who live streams his latest catch to his customers in the series Devon and Cornwall. Meanwhile, it's the Chase Celebrity Special on ITV at 4:30 and Gladiators on BBC One at 4:35. Your evening choices start at 6 on ITV with The 1% Club, followed by Rob Brydon's The Floor at 7, while over on Channel 4 you can meet French Bulldog Spud in The Doghouse at 6:50, followed by The Great Pottery Throwdown at 7:50. At 8, you can choose between BBC One's Call the Midwife and ITV's Limitless Win with Ant and Dec. And at 9, there is the start of BBC One's four-part adaptation of the 1954 novel Lord of the Flies. Channel 4's Secret Genius with Alan Carr and Susie Dent, and the first episode of a new espionage series on ITV, Betrayal. Gogglebox fans have a double bill on Channel 4 at 10 and 11, and the Oscar-winning romantic fantasy drama Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore and a pottery wheel, is your film choice on ITV at 10:15. Now, for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday, Channel 4 has episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond from 7:50 a.m, Frasier from 9:10 a.m, American Pickers at 11:10, Car SOS at 12:10, Find It, Fix It, Flog It at 1:10, and Chateau DIY at 5. Over on ITV, it's Dickinson's Real Deal at 2 p.m, and you can escape to the country at 3:30 on BBC Two. Then it's the new regular soap slots. EastEnders, 7:30 on BBC One every weeknight except Friday. Emmerdale, 8 o'clock, and Coronation Street, 8:30 on ITV, and on to Monday. Four new pairs arrive, desperate to stand out, during their first team challenge in the series Chateau DIY, Win the Dream on Channel 4 at 5 p.m. And it's all hands on deck as the Fletchers gather in their expanded flock for an essential health check in Fletcher's Family Farm on ITV at 7:30. Sausage Bake, Aubergine Noodles and Treacle Tart are on the menu in Jamie's Feasts for a Fiver at 8 o'clock on Channel 4, which is followed at 9 by Guy Martin's House Without Bills, with tips on how to make your home cheaper to heat. Also at 9, there's episode 3 of Silent Witness on BBC One and episode 2 of ITV's espionage series Betrayal. There's a new series, Small Profits, on BBC Two at 10, followed by 2 episodes of What We Do in the Shadows at 11 and 11.25. 2 episodes of Concorde, The Race for Supersonic, are on Channel 4 from 10.30, charting the battle to build the world's first supersonic airliner. BBC One continues its industry series at 10.40, while over on ITV at 10.45, the Social Media Murders documentary exposes the online plot executed by the killers of 13-year-old Ollie Stevens. You have a film to complete your Monday evening options. A canoe trip becomes a fight for survival for 4 city friends in Deliverance at 11.50 on BBC Two. On Tuesday, the Culinary Challenge MasterChef, The Professionals, returns on BBC One at 8pm, while over on Channel 4, you can get some tips on securing ultra-low fares in bargain holiday secrets. At 9 o'clock, True Crime Documentary, 24 Hours in Police Custody, is on Channel 4. Silent Witness continues on BBC One. And there is a new series on ITV, The Summit. 14 people bid to win a share of £200,000 by climbing one of New Zealand's highest peaks. Channel 4's 999, What Happened Next, is at 10, followed by Manhunt at 11.05, while BBC One has 2 episodes of its series Trying from 10.40, followed by the return of the award-winning comedy Dinosaur at 11.40. The murder of Alice Ruggles is the subject of ITV's Social Media Murders episode at 10.55. Next, your programmes for Wednesday. MasterChef The Professionals continues on BBC One, and Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It on Channel 4, both at 8pm. At 9, there's BBC One's Can You Keep a Secret series. The Summit continues on ITV, and Channel 4 has Michael Jackson, The Trial. It's the final of Black Ops on BBC One at 9.30, and at 10, you can choose between comedy, One Foot in the Grave on BBC Two, and First Dates, Be My Valentine on Channel 4. You have Gogglebox on Channel 4 at 11.05, The Final Digging for Britain on BBC Two at 11.30, and Social Media Murders on ITV at 11.40, this episode examining the murder of Bianca Devins. And on to Thursday, a money-making app for parents, children's baking kits, an AI-powered cat flap, and portable composting toilets are the business pitches from budding entrepreneurs in Dragon's Den on BBC One at 8, followed by The Apprentice at 9. Over on Channel 4, George Clark's Building Home is at 8, followed by the final part of Michael Jackson, The Trial, at 9. Grantchester is ITV's 9 o'clock choice, and at 10 you have The Apprentice, Unfinished Business, on BBC Two, and a documentary about migrant boat crossings into the UK, Not Welcome, The Battle to Stop the Boats, on Channel 4. Romantic drama Ghost is on ITV at 10.45. It's the final of Mystery Road, Origin, on BBC Two at 11. You can spend another 24 hours in A&E on Channel 4 at 11.35 and follow climber Alex Honnold's bid to conquer the El Capitan Rock formation in California's Yosemite National Park without ropes on BBC Two at 11.55. And finally, Friday. It'll Be All Right on the Night starts your evening options on ITV at 7.30, and on Channel 4, the UK and NATO alliance is examined in Frontline, Our Soldiers Facing Putin at 8, followed by Gogglebox at 9. Also at 9, ITV's Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy series continues, and at 10.50 on ITV, Social Murder Mysteries examines the case of Abby Fisher. Your evening choices conclude with First Dates, Be My Valentine, at 11.05 on Channel 4. That's it for this week. We hope you find plenty of programmes to enjoy, and we look forward to updating you again next week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, February 7th. And there's drama on Radio 4 in the afternoon, Transcendental Wild Oats by Louisa May Alcott, 3 o'clock, Radio 4. Opera on 3 on Saturday has Handel's Ariadante, 6 p.m, Radio 3. Loose Ends with Chat and Music with Clive Anderson is on Radio 4, alternatively at 6:15. That's Loose Ends with Clive Anderson. While This Cultural Life, pianist Imogen Cooper, is the topic at 7:15 on Radio 4. Conversation Extra with Laurence Olivier, 9 o'clock, Radio 4 Extra, followed at 9:30 by Great Lives, Vivian Lee. On to Sunday, and just a minute, the panel game, if you missed it in the week, Radio 4, 12:30. Trump and Greenland, how MAGA, which is Make America Great Again, went Arctic. Radio 4 for this, 1:30, Sunday afternoon, February 8th. Opening Lines, Gone with the Wind. It's a discussion about Margaret Mitchell's epic novel. Just before you can hear the American Civil War novel on Radio 4. So Opening Lines, Gone with the Wind, Episode 1, 2:45, Sunday afternoon. John York explores the epic novel. And then at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, drama on 4, Gone with the Wind, a stunning tale of love and loss, dramatised by Rachel Joyce. While on Radio 2, Sounds of the 70s with Bob Harris, 3 o'clock over on Radio 2. There's a music quiz, Counterpoint, on Radio 4 at 4:30 on Sunday afternoon. While a showcase of love poems is The Verve, 10 past 5, Radio 4, Sunday afternoon. Sibelius' Symphony No. 5 you can hear on Radio 3 at 8 o'clock. While Word of Mouth with Michael Rosen is alternatively on Radio 4 at the same time, 8 o'clock Sunday night. On to programmes then that are serialised right throughout the week, same time, same radio station, Monday to Friday. So each day, same radio station, same time, Monday to Friday. Book of the Week is The Colour of Home. It's a memoir by the former Home Secretary, Savid Javid. 11:45 in the morning, Radio 4. Classical Live, the daily concert, this week showcasing French music, is at 1 o'clock on Radio 3 all week. Well, Composer of the Week is Henrik Schultz on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. Zeb Soans has his usual relaxed evenings with Classic FM at 7 p.m. all week. While Book of Bedtime, James by Percy Everett, a reimagining of the adventures of Huckleberry Finn, 10:45 each night all week, Radio 4. On to the individual highlights then for the rest of the week, going back to Monday, February 9th. And the final part of Understand, An American Journey, Episode 4, at 11 o'clock on Radio 4. The idea of freedom is foundational to America. But whose freedom and what kind? Understand, An American Journey, Radio 4, 11 a.m. And Monday night, The Blues Show with Kerris Matthews is on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. Tuesday, February 10th. And the drama, This Thing of Darkness. It's episode 2 of 5. It's on Radio 4 at 2:25. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock. Alternatively, Historical Drama is on Radio 4 Extra, Noon Ghosts, also at 3. What's Up, Docs? The Doctors discuss the science of kissing on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. And you heard it here first. Chris McCausland hosts the panel game about sounds, 6:30 p.m, Radio 4. As it's a Tuesday, the latest In Touch news for the blind and partially sighted at 8:40 on Radio 4. Or Jamie Cullum has his jazz show on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. Wednesday, February 11th, and the drama Rays of Darkness, an autobiographical drama by Gwyneth Lewis, 2:15 for this, Radio 4. There's Alternative Murder and Drama on Radio 4 Extra at 3 o'clock a fair exchange. In the Radio 4 comedy slot, the making of Colin Holt is at 6:30 on Radio 4. While Adam Fleming returns with Antisocial, where he investigates an issue of the day. Radio 4, 8 p.m. Wednesday. While The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is on Radio 2 at 9. Thursday, February 12th, In Our Time with Misha Glennie, 9 o'clock in the morning, Radio 4. There's drama, Good People, The Great Reset, episode 1 of this drama, on Radio 4 on Thursday afternoon at 2:15. The Briefing Room, discussion of a story in the news, is on Radio 4 at 4. Well, Randy Feltflace's Destruction Manual, A Puppet, discusses climate change, 6:30 p.m, Radio 4 in the comedy slot. And yes, I did say a puppet. Alexi Sayle's Strangers on a Train, the comedian chats to train passengers on Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. While The Country Show with Bob Harris is on Radio 2, Thursday night at 9. And finally, Friday, February 13th, the drama Limelight, Wolf Valley. It's an eco-thriller and it's part 4 of 5 on Radio 4 at 2:15 on Friday afternoon. Child in a Dark Wood is an alternative drama on Radio 4 Extra at 3. While Life Without the Moon, Alan Davis examines and imagines a world without the moon. 2:45, Radio 4, Friday afternoon. Round off your week with the news quiz on Radio 4 at 6:30. Hopefully some comedy in that. Add to Playlist has a list of musical connections, 5 in a row, all slightly connected to each other. 7:15, Radio 4. Well, Friday night is Music Night, a showcase of composers with alternative careers. 7:30, Radio 3. Finally, Americast, the week in USA politics. Rounded up for you with Justin Webb. Radio 4, 11 o'clock, Friday night. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
Here are the answers for this week's quiz. Question 1. News. Which actor has said it is unlikely he will return in the next instalment of the Paddington film franchise? Hugh Bonneville. Question 2. Which judge of the Great British Bake Off has announced they are stepping down? Dame Prue Leith. Question 3. Sport. Who was the top try scorer at the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup? Braxton Sorensen McGee. Question 4. How many times did Andy Murray reach the Australian Open final? 5. Question 5. Remember when? The British government banned embroidery on women's underwear and nightwear. Salvador Dali published his autobiography, comedian Billy Connolly was born, and Walt Disney had another cinematic hit with Bambi. Question 6. Lionel Richie had a UK number one single with Hello. Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap was released. The boat race was postponed for a day after Cambridge's boat was damaged and actress Diana Dawes died. Question 7. Who am I? A politician. I was born in Bath in 1947. I entered Parliament in 1987 as a Conservative MP. I famously accused my political boss, Michael Howard, of having something of the night about him. I have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing and hosted the game show Cleverdix. I am Anne Widdicombe. Question 8. A soprano, I was born in Germany in 1760. I was praised for the precision and clarity of my voice. I married the actor Joseph Lang in 1780, and 2 years later, my sister, Constance, married Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had expressed an interest in marrying me. I am Maria Aloysia Weber Lang. Question 9. Maths Impossy Puzzles. That's quite a family, said Alan. How old are you? Here's a teaser for you, Greg chuckled. There are 5 of us boys spaced evenly 2 years apart, and I'm the oldest. I'm 1.5 times as old as my youngest brother. How old am I? I am 24 years old. And question 10. Donuts and eclairs. That's fine for the party. You must have got about 50 in all. Nancy shook her head. Oh, not that many. But I got all that they had. I got as many of each as its price in pence. And the lot came to as many pounds as the number of eclairs and as many pence as the number of donuts. How many of each? Twelve eclairs and 33 donuts. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Albion Match Report. Improving Portsmouth stretched their unbeaten run to 4 games as Connor Chaplin's opener teed up an emphatic victory against woeful fellow Championship strugglers West Bromwich Albion. Chaplin swept home his first goal in 24 games since returning to the club on loan this season from Milanek Ali's smart pullback from the left. Ali also netted his first Pompey goal of the season and for the club when he slid the ball through keeper Max O'Leary's legs from Andre Dozzle's pass for a 2-0 interval lead. The Baggies played like a side resigned to a 5th defeat in 6, lacking confidence, intensity and any goal threat, with just 1 lame off-target attempt in the first half. Portsmouth had no trouble completing the job in front of an increasingly relaxed Fratton Park crowd, with Ebu Adams also on target as they moved up to 20th, 4 points clear of the relegation zone. They leapfrogged the Baggies, who slip to 21st, just 3 points above the bottom 3, having played a game more than all of the sides below them. But as much as the host impress in a busy performance, full of pace, movement and intent, West Brom were abysmal, showing just why they had lost 10 in a row away from home before last week's last gasp draw against Derby County. Chaplin could have made it 1-0 inside 2 minutes with a flicked effort that went wide at the near post. And he also went close with a drilled strike across goal before calmly slotting Pompey ahead from Ali's measured pass. Ali's equally cool one-on-one finish rewarded continued attacking purpose and pressure, while Terry Devlin and Adrian Segesic also had chances to add to the advantage. Adams did increase the advantage within 4 minutes of the restart, firing home from Chaplin's cushioned volley to as good as seal the victory and further demoralise a West Brom side who have now already lost 12 matches away from home this term. Mikey Johnston did manage an attempt on target for the Baddies, their only one of the game, when his curling long-range strike was well tipped over by Pompey keeper Nicholas Smith. But Portsmouth remained in full control and could easily have added to their lead, with the only blemish an ankle injury suffered by Colby Bishop in the second half. Eric Ramsey told BBC, "It was tough. We have to own the performance, take accountability and look inward as individuals and as a collective. And we have to get better. I am concerned we didn't handle what was an inevitable quick start, a team that really draws on the crowd. We set up in a way trying not to feed that momentum, but we did the opposite and it affected the players and we need to deal with it better. I am disappointed we haven't been able to move the group forward in the short space of time I have been here. There were some fundamentals missing for the first half that start to lead to the performance feeling short, and that contributes to the level of confidence. We have to address some of the basics in terms of competition, of second balls, and that as we regain possession, we are neat and tidy."
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star, Tuesday, the 3rd of February. Albion infighting and off-field drama mirrors chaos on the pitch. This article is by Lewis Cox. Where to even start with this Albion boardroom fallout? Momentum and form is spiralling, sending them towards League One. A change of head coach to bring in Eric Ramsey has not had the desired effect. Indeed, things have unravelled further. The off-field storm, blame game and attempts to rewrite history when it comes to the sack club president and sporting director Andrew Nesta matters little in the here and now. It will be a big factor, however, if we are picking the balance out of a relegation post-mortem in May. But right now, Shailen Patel and the people beneath him have to ensure Albion can somehow move away from the precipice of the third-tier abyss. It is very likely that come Tuesday night, the club will be in the relegation places. The optics could hardly be worse and fans are right to fear the situation reeks of relegation. Much of the blame there lies at the door of Nesta. A close confidant and long-term associate of chairman and owner Patel handed the reins to footballing affairs. He was appointed by the owner to make the sporting calls and that is why he carried the can for the desperate failings. It appears to have descended into something of a civil war in the Hawthorns boardroom. Nesta was the chief strategist working above the likes of Director of Football Operations Ian Pearce on matters like recruitment and appointments. Much of Bill Cole's 2 years in charge of Albion have been a disaster on the field, certainly from the moment Carlos Corberan departed on Christmas Eve 2024. Operations and decisions since have been a total disaster. The failed appointment of Raphael Wicky, the number one choice, broke down in the 11th hour when it should never have. It was an amateurish look. Indeed, Albion's last 12 months have been little short of shameful for a club of their size and history. Tony Mowbray's brief return was a desperately sad debacle and Ryan Mason endured 6 months where he could not get things going. He was given every chance by Nesta, who pleaded patience in his pre-Christmas statement, but the inevitable could be avoided no longer on January the 6th. Nesta's attempts to cleanse his hands of Ramsey's appointment do not wash. He was quoting the club's statement backing Ramsey's unique coaching journey, leadership qualities and attention to detail. After just 4 games, winless Ramsey is already under pressure following a desperately bad start. Nesta's signings have been largely disastrous. There have been the odd success, but far too many failings. There were failings before him too, with Pearce running the recruitment drive. Tam Abani at $3.4 million is the poorest, and one that Albion could simply not afford to get wrong. It would have been a desperate failure if he was a free transfer, but he remains the ownership's second most expensive transfer. Little wonder Nesta was asking former boss Tony Mowbray why Banny was not in the side, a move which did not go down well. A new technical director is set to join, but will arrive after the transfer deadline. It was never the plan for the new arrival. He's not a Nesta replacement and was coming on board regardless to check in during the January window again. But again, the look is a confused one. The likelihood is the departed Nesta at the very least and a role to play in the recruitment of the imminent technical director. That in itself is not necessarily a problem, but creates more confusion. The timing of a club president and sporting director's public fallout on the eve of a transfer window is not ideal. Regardless of how disastrous it has been, at the moment the state of affairs off the field mirror those on it and typify a club seemingly hurtling to relegation. Mercifully, there is still time for something to be salvaged from this mess. Developer appeals after told it can't build more homes on landslide estate. A developer has appealed a decision to block more homes from being built on an estate previously cut off by a landslide. Dunedin Homes, the developer behind the 53-home estate off Hales Owen Road in Craigleith, was blocked from adding six more homes to the development by Samwell Council last year. The estate, which was completed in 2020, has been plagued by issues including several landslides that left a huge mound of earth blocking the road and cutting off a dozen homes. The developer has appealed the decision to the government planning inspectors in a bid to get the ruling overturned. The three and four bed homes would be built on a patch of land previously used as a storage yard and haul road during the construction of the wider estate, around 150 metres away from Hayden Cross Drive, where landslides spiralled over retaining wall, leaving several residents blocked in. A total of 30 objections were made against the plans before Samwell Council made a decision. Rejecting the proposal, the council's planner said, the development would have a significant impact on privacy and overlooking of existing residential properties at lower land levels and would appear overly dominant and overbearing from the habitable rooms and gardens of those properties. The site layout would be cramped with poorly designed runs of parking to frontages and areas of communal bin stores. The local authority added the application did not adequately recognise the nearby nature reserve, wildlife corridor or conservation sites. The subsidence in nearby Hayden Cross Drive was first seen 2 years ago when a tree fell in the nearby woods. Heavy rain and bad weather throughout the year came to a head in the run-up to Christmas, with a huge mound of earth leaving the road completely locked. The tons of soil left the cul-de-sac cut off and homeowners without access to their driveways. A statement included with the application said, the site is in a sustainable location and relates well to the wider context to the site and has been designed with the aim of creating a vibrant and inclusive community. Donut Day is on way at bakery chain. Polish bakeries across the West Midlands are set to be bursting with donuts next month as staff and customers celebrate a sugar-filled annual tradition. In a similar celebration to Shrove Pancake Tuesday, Fat Thursday is a Christian celebration that takes place on the final Thursday before the fasting period of Lent begins. The celebration is observed in countries like Germany, Italy, Spain and Greece, and traditionally is a day dedicated to indulging in rich foods such as cakes, sweets and other dishes typically avoided during Lent. In Poland, however, Fat Thursday, or Twisty Kwiatek, is marked by a nationwide celebration with one treat standing out above all others, a traditional filled donut. It's an annual tradition that staff at Masowa look forward to every year, and 2026 will be no different when the celebration returns on Thursday, February the 12th. The bakery chain has 8 outlets across the West Midlands, including Warsaw, Kidderminster, West Bromwich, Wellington and Shrewsbury. Last year, celebrating its second Fat Thursday, the bakery's Wellington branch sold more than 600 of those sugary treats in the first 2 hours of opening. How to reduce risk of suffering from a stroke. Monitor your blood pressure and make lifestyle changes. This article is by Camilla Foster. A leading charity has warned that strokes in the UK would increase by almost 42% unless urgent action is taken to reduce people's risk. New projections from the Stroke Association estimate that by 2035, there could be more than 151,000 strokes each year, the equivalent of 414 people every day. This marks a sharp rise from the current figures of around 280 strokes a day, or 106,565 annually. In light of these worrying statistics, we spoke to Alexis Kolodzi of the Stroke Association to explore what steps people can take to reduce their risk of stroke. The main message is that we can take steps to reduce the risk of having a stroke. In fact, 9 in 10 strokes are preventable, according to the Stroke Association's website. Some members of the public think that strokes are the inevitable consequence of older age, but that's obviously not the case. If you take action on blood pressure, follow healthy living advice, and make sure that heart conditions are picked up and monitored, all of these things can all have a significant positive impact on your stroke risk. The main risk factor that we can't control is age. Most strokes happen in people who are over the age of 70, but it is important to be aware that anyone can have a stroke. What we're seeing at the moment is the rate of incidence is rising in younger people faster than it's rising in older people. So we're seeing more strokes happen to people who are under the age of 55, and we think they are the most likely to be due to factors around lifestyle. High blood pressure is always a big risk factor for strokes and plays a part in about half of all strokes, according to the Stroke Association. High blood pressure puts more pressure on the arteries all over your body, but specifically in your brain, that can cause a bleed, explains Kolodzi. A blood vessel rupturing causes a hemorrhagic stroke. Also, when your arteries and blood flow breaks down, it's more likely for clots to form. Then, if they travel to the brain and block blood flow, that causes an ischemic stroke that's caused by a clot. There are ways to reduce the risk, including regularly checking your blood pressure. It's never too early to start checking your blood pressure. You can get your blood pressure checked at a GP, at most pharmacies, and a lot of supermarkets now are starting to have blood pressure checking machines too. You can also check your blood pressure at home, as these blood pressure checking machines are much cheaper and much more available than they used to be. On the NHS website, high blood pressure is generally defined as a consistent long-term reading of 140 over 90 or higher when checked by a healthcare professional. People are also advised to book an NHS health check. If you are aged 40 to 74 and do not have a pre-existing health condition, you should be invited to NHS health check by your GP or local council every 5 years. One of the most effective initiatives in the UK to help reduce the incidence of a stroke is the NHS health check, says Kolodzi. During the NHS health check, they can check lots of different things that can increase your risk of lots of different health conditions. But it's really important part of that is blood pressure check, said Kolodzi. If you get that invitation from your GP and you're over 40, you should absolutely go. Exercise is also important because it's healthy blood flow. And if you have a healthy blood flow, it keeps your arteries healthy and reduces the chance of clots and the risk of your arteries rupturing. People often think, oh, I must have to be super active to reduce my risk of stroke. But actually, that's not true. Even just going out and having a walk around the block or doing some gardening is really helpful in reducing your stroke risk. People are also advised to be mindful of salt intake, which can increase blood pressure. And of course, smoking is bad as it can clog up arteries, and give up smoking can reduce the risk dramatically.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Tanya with some information about eye exercises. Traditional optometry has always been focused on correcting vision via spectacles, contact lenses, or devices such as magnifiers. However, in the modern world, where our visual requirements are different and often more stressful, many optometrists, and indeed individuals, are needing to consider managing situations and symptoms in a more holistic way to take account of eye strain resulting from screen time. The online world is full of articles, videos and tips about eye exercises and their value, but do they really do any good? Here we look at some of the commonly suggested exercises for your eyes and consider whether they can make a difference for anyone with a visual impairment. Perhaps the first thing to remember about eye exercises is that they can't improve your eyesight or correct a major problem. There are, however, some circumstances where exercises can give you some respite from tired eyes, or they may help strengthen your eye muscles and make it a little easier to focus when needed. Exercises could potentially help relieve symptoms such as eye strain, headaches when reading, difficulty in concentrating on screens, or if you suffer from occasional bouts of blurred or double vision. If you have a particular concern about your eyes or a decline in your vision, it's essential to talk to an eye care professional rather than simply relying on a program of exercises. It's unlikely that exercises will damage your eyes, but if you have any concerns or notice that previously minor problems are becoming more frequent or more severe, do not hesitate to contact your local optician or eye clinic. So what are some simple eye exercises that you can do at home? First, let's look at blinking. Regular blinking is a natural reaction for many people, but there is a theory that your blink rate drops when you're staring at a computer or phone screen. A reduced blink rate can lead to dry, tired, or irritated eyes or headaches. If you feel any of these symptoms starting, take notice. Sit back and make a conscious effort to blink more often, for a full second each time. Regular blinking should keep your eyes lubricated and help tired eyes. Now let's think about changing focus. There are two exercises around changing focus to help relieve eye strain. The first is sometimes called a 20-20-20 exercise and is designed to help your eye muscles when they become tired from focusing on the same thing for too long. To help overcome this, you should take a 20-second break every 20 minutes and use those full 20 seconds to focus on something that is 20 feet away. In modern measurements, it should really be 20 seconds every 20 minutes to focus on something 6 meters away, but the old-style 20-foot measurement used here makes for a more memorable exercise name. Regardless of whether you work in feet or meters, the idea is that changing your focus will give your eyes an opportunity to relax, reducing the chance of eye strain. The other exercise centres on switching your eyes between focus on objects that are close by and those that are further away. An easy option is to hold your two thumbs in the air, one near your face and the other one at arm's length. Focus first on the near thumb for 2 seconds, switch to the far thumb for 2 seconds, then switch your focus to something across the room, and then finally to something even further away, for example, something on the other side of the road. Repeat this process 5 times. Next on the list is rolling your eyes, and this isn't just about showing what you think of what someone else has just said. There are a couple of variations of eye rolling exercises designed to increase the flexibility of your eye muscles. For the first one, sit in a comfortable spot and slowly roll your eyes in a clockwise direction around 10 times while keeping everything in focus. Now repeat the exercise, but rolling your eyes 10 times anti-clockwise. For the second exercise, imagine a large number 8, about 10 feet or 3 meters in front of you. Slowly follow the lines of the imaginary number 8 with your eyes several times in one direction, then do the same in the other direction. And the last exercise to consider is using your palms to help relax your eyes. If you feel your eyes could do with a rest, gently cup your palms over closed eyes. Make sure you don't push the heels of your hands into your eyes. It's important not to put any pressure on the eyeballs. Cover your eyes to block out all light for around 30 seconds until any residual images fade to black. The purpose of this exercise is to soothe strained or tired eyes. And it's a good one to finish on because it's important to rest your eyes after exercising them to make sure you don't overwork your eye muscles. After exercising, full relaxation can be achieved by closing your eyes for 2 minutes or looking into the far distance for 2 minutes. It's important to remember that whilst these exercises can help relieve eye strain and fatigue, they do not replace regular eye health checks. For those already under the watch of an ophthalmology team, checks will be set at regular intervals dependent on individual needs. Otherwise, regular eye examinations are recommended every 2 years.
DNF soundings.
Some news from Sandwell Visually Impaired, from an article that's on the SVI website, sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk. A grand afternoon at the theatre. Last month, SVI members enjoyed a Saturday matinee visit to the Grand Theatre, Wolverhampton, to see the acclaimed musical Six. The afternoon began with a relaxed gathering at the Moon Underwater pub opposite the theatre, where members had a light lunch and refreshments before heading over the road. Ahead of the performance, the group took part in a touch tour, giving everyone the opportunity to experience the costumes at close hand. Theatre staff were welcoming, informative and attentive throughout, helping to create an inclusive and enjoyable experience for all. The performance itself was lively, engaging and full of energy. With its concert-style format and outstanding vocals, Six brought the stories of Henry VIII's six wives to life in a modern and entertaining way. The show was very well received, with members thoroughly enjoying the music, atmosphere and storytelling. SVI member Stevie shared her experience. She said, "We really enjoyed the day. It was Mom's and my first touch tour and we genuinely felt like VIPs. That's very important people. The staff were so attentive and being able to see the costumes up close was a real highlight." This successful outing also highlights SVI's strong user-led approach. The event was organised by SVI member Lisa, who is now taking the lead on coordinating some of SVI's activities. Her efforts helped make the day both enjoyable and well organised and reflect the value of members shaping and leading SVI experiences. Sandra, SVI development worker, said, "I'm really pleased that Lisa has volunteered to take the lead on SVI's Socialise and Active 60 activities. This is a true reflection of SVI's user-led ethos. Lisa is keen to organise more theatre trips and other events. Watch this space. If you'd like to take part in future theatre trips or social events, please keep an eye on our activity letters and emails, website and Facebook, or contact the SVI office for more information. We warmly welcome members who would like to get involved and help shape upcoming activities, as well as attend them. And thanks to Lisa and Stevie for their contributions to this article."
DNF Soundings.
Hello, I am Lindsay, and welcome to discovering a little about handy musical hobbies. Handbells are probably one of the most accessible and basic of musical instruments. Fortunately, Sue, the leader of a visually impaired handbell ringing team in Stockport, Greater Manchester, UK, kindly agreed to a telephone conversation to literally describe the ups and downs of playing. Wolfhew House in Stockport is a centre serving the visually impaired and the deaf community. The building itself was left to the charity and is still run by volunteers today for various activities, one of which is handbell ringing. Sue got involved unexpectedly with leading the Stockport visually impaired handbell ringing team over 20 years ago when out performing with her sighted team.
I was actually playing with a sighted team, and we were playing in a garden centre, and this staff came over and just said that they found a set of handbells in Wolfhew House, and would anybody be interested in starting up a team?
She explains here what type of handbells the teams play and why their ringing technique is different.
Well, you could have any number of people. I mean, at the moment, we've got five. There's two methods of ringing handbells. You can ring in hand, where you actually hold them, and you can either have two bells, or a lot of people play four bells, two bells in each hand. The blind do, because obviously it's more difficult for them. My other tip, we play off the table. So all the bells are on the table, and we just pick them up and ring them when the note that's required. That's how you've got different sorts of handbells. You've got American bells and English bells.
What's the difference between the two, then?
English bells are more traditional. They have leather handles and the clappers, which actually strike bells, either leather, plastic, or like a felt, depending on the size of the bell. The American bells are plastic. They have white handles for, like, the white notes on a piano, and they have black handles for the black notes on a piano. And their clappers are plastic, which you can turn.
Are they all cast bells? Are they heavy?
No, not the ones that we play normal handbells. You can get some that are very big. I mean, it's like swinging around two bags of sugar. So they are heavy, but we don't use big bells for the blind.
I understand there's 3 octave and 5 octave, is that?
Try 5 octaves, or you can, anything in between.
There has to be a more vocal approach to learning musical arrangements for the visually impaired handbell ringers, although even sighted players learn to use a simple word search style chart, indicating number or note specific handbells, including rhythm sequences, in order to play a tune, unlike traditional score written music. Here Sue again explains method adaptions and the helpfulness of choosing team familiar tunes and songs.
Blind has to learn by a little bit at a time, and you don't have such complicated, you would only play 2-3 notes at a time. They can't see when you come in. You can't have a conductor. So everything is done by just learning. We do quite a lot of well-known songs, classical music, old songs, modern songs. And I tend to try and get pieces that they know. That's how they do it. And then gradually they learn, and then they know when they're coming in.
I know a lot of handbell teams probably have audiences. I know one in Essex which actually allows some of the audience members to come up who are visually impaired and have a go at ringing the bells. But I think you are very much unique in the fact that you have a whole team.
Although informal UK mini, regional and national rallies take place, there are more formal events where handbell ringers can tackle complex and larger range music compositions, like regional orchestras or the International Symposium, held in different countries every 2 years. Whatever size event, it is an opportunity for the handbell ringers to showcase their skills and share in performing music together. It seems this unique handbell ringing team really enjoy the social aspect of joining in mixed ability handbell rallies.
Do you get to competition standard? No, this is all just for enjoyment and fun.
Yes, we tend to join up together every so often in areas and have an enjoyable day all ringing together. The blind team have joined in with a piece. You play a solo bit, which they've done, and then they join in. We have a matched ring. What we did, because at that particular time there were only a few of them, the three of us, and they came and joined in our sighted team. And they knew the tune because we had done it, and so they just joined in, and, you know, we would say, D, and they just joined in.
The Stockport Handbell Ringers team themselves must get an awful lot of sense of achievement from learning, like you say, maybe a fairly complicated piece, but actually because they know the familiar song, it makes it easier for them to get the essence of it.
I would think so. I mean, they seem to enjoy it and they come up each week.
When asking about handbell ringing benefits, it became clear that achievement of mastering songs was not the only uplifting experience for the Stockport team, but also for the wider community. Sue recounts some of these occasions.
We have played for WI, we've played for, well, other groups within the Wolfhew House, played for a nursery, and one Christmas, and did lots of carols with them. So, yes, they have, but it's more we meet each week, and they enjoy it.
Thank you, Sue, for being my special guest. Interested further in handbell ringing, you can contact the charity Handbell Ringers of Great Britain, HRGB, on their website www.handbells.org.uk.
DNF Soundings.
Thank you to all our volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week. Mia, Jan, Gavin, Linda, Janet and Trevor. Thanks to Sarah Ann for doing the quiz and to Sue for picking the articles that everyone's read. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Let's hope for some brighter weather soon.
Thanks, Pam. Not sure about the weather, though. It's still going to be a bit on the cold side, a bit windy at times. And when I was coming back from shopping the other day, the sleet was blowing quite sharply in my face. So we're not over with the rough weather just yet. As I've indicated before, we're looking at trying to revamp what the Talking News does a little to try and bring in more listeners. One of the things I'll be doing is including some news from SVI about upcoming activities for the week ahead, which I hope will be useful at the start of the paper. Don't forget too that we're on the internet. You can stream us from our page within SVI's website, and we're also available. I've been trying out chapterising podcasts, and you hear announcements at the beginning of the podcast to say that it is chapterised, and you can take advantage of that if you're using an Android phone by using Podcast Addict, or on the iPhone, the Apple Podcast app, or indeed the Castro app, which some iPhone users swear by. So hope that's useful information to you of how to listen to us. But for now, I have to go as we're running out of space. But I know coming up is an edition of In Touch, very much about the Macular Society, which I think some local members of SVI do attend their group meetings once or month or twice every 2 months or so. That's it for now. Hope you've enjoyed listening, and we'll be back with you, of course, next week. Bye bye for now.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.